Please, speak as you might to a young child or a golden retriever.
It's an unfair game.
They're schemers. Schemers trying to control their little worlds.
Rich get richer, that's the law of the land.
It's just money.
Blasphemy! This is madness!
I drink your milkshake!
Hey everybody, welcome back to Milkshakes, Markets, Madness. My name is John Kutzmita. I am joined here with Brent Johnson, the man behind the dollar milkshake theory. If you do not know what that is, you are in for a treat. Maybe not specifically on this episode, but certainly the full catalog of videos that we have available for you. I recommend you start with the playlist at the top of our YouTube channel that is called Start Here. There is a presentation by Brent going over the dollar milkshake theory, a number of video clips that I think greatly support that. But in this video, we are going to more or less do what we call our full length episode. They all seem to be getting full length nowadays, but we're looking at more or less the week that has just passed and getting a little more deeper into some of those topics. Brent, what do you have to say about this past week?
Well, you know, I'm not sure because it was... It had kind of a boring end to it. It was. I would almost say it was a whole boring week. The last 3 or 4 hours of this, I thought we might get some fireworks on Friday. And we had some fireworks early after the non-farm payrolls came out, but then it was just really kind of a boring day. Sometimes, you know, at the end of the summer, heading into a three-day weekend, you get some fireworks, either to the upside or to the downside. And early, I thought we might just run away to the upside, and then everything kind of rolled over and then kind of finished fairly flat for the day. And, you know, I would almost call this week a little bit like what we have talked about all year is this violently sideways, right? You know, the markets kind of made a high at the end of July, early August. They pulled back for a few weeks into last week. And then, you know, I think markets, equity markets in general were, I don't know, they were up 1% to 2% this week, or maybe even a little bit more. Maybe the NASDAQ was up 3% or 4%. But what I thought was interesting was that there was a little bit of something for everybody this week, which doesn't bring any clarity to the market, and it actually contributes to the uncertainty, right? And markets don't like uncertainty. What I mean by that is I think there was enough data released this week that there was a little bit of something for everybody, especially today. Earlier this week, I think the data came in a little dovish, right? And so markets traded up. And even into today, when the non-farm payrolls came out, the number, the top line number was hawkish, but the payrolls number, or the earnings per hour was weak, and that was seen as dovish, and the overall unemployment rate jumped, which was seen as dovish. And so markets kind of jumped on that pretty quickly. The dollar sold off hard. And then a couple hours later, we had some other data points came out that were hawkish, and you know, they exceeded expectations, and you know, the dollar jumped really high, and all those equity gains that had happened in the first hour or so were gone. And then things kind of just leveled out for the rest of the day. So I think, you know, if you're bearish, I think there was enough data that came out this week to support your view. If you're bullish, I think enough data came out this week to support your view. And so I don't think, you know, there was anything really decided this week. And what's interesting is we have a lot of data again next week. The following week, we have CPI. But then we've got, I think, kind of a couple dead weeks until we get to the Fed meeting at the end of the month. And so to me, it's going to be really interesting to see how this month plays out. A lot of times as we get into the fall, you know, September is typically not a great month for the market, or September and October, like whenever you get volatility for whatever reason, you often see that in the fall. And so we're kind of getting into that. And it's because of all this uncertainty that I am still kind of keeping my same viewpoint, is that I'm happy to sort of sit on the sidelines in, you know, I have equities that I've owned for literally years. Those have hedges against them. I've got a lot in T-bills just sitting there earning over 5% while we wait. And I don't see a big reason to go after anything in a big way right now. The only thing that I've bought with any conviction in the last couple of weeks is, you know, some corn and some wheat and even coffee. Some of the agricultural commodities. But, you know, I'm happy to just kind of be very careful, be prudent, and wait for a better opportunity, because right now I don't see one.
Awesome. Great little recap of the week, what you took away from it, and kind of where your positions are still. The violently sideways aspect, I'd love to be able to point people to one particular video, but it's just something we've highlighted consistently throughout the year. It's really been a big theme for 2023. Some of the other things you mentioned there, the mixed data, some of it was dovish, some of it was hawkish. We have a playlist that includes all of our midweek updates. There is a midweek update called When Doves Cry. So if you're unfamiliar with those terms, you can definitely get a little more into the details in that video. So yes, as you mentioned, everything there, we had some job openings data that kind of kicked off the week in a more dovish manner. Non-farm payroll, again, as you mentioned, was kind of mixed once you started looking under the hood at the, past the headline number. You also had some pretty sizable revisions on previous months. So the data was noisy. So, you know, it started out with a bang today and ended with a whimper, as it kind of felt like it did all week, you know. And what else that's been somewhat subdued or boring has been the VIX. What are you taking away from this lack of excitement in the VIX?
Well, I think that, you know, the lack of excitement in the VIX has kind of contributed to the markets holding up fairly well this year. There hasn't been any risk that has gotten any real traction that lasted more than a couple days or a couple weeks at the most. Every time the VIX or the perceived level of risk in the market starts to rise, you know, something comes out and kind of rolls it over. And, you know, the VIX had its lowest weekly close since, I think, 2019 today. I will be the first person to say that I don't consider myself an expert on the VIX. You know, my friends Mike Green and Jason Buck and, you know, some of these other people who deal in volatility on a daily basis, you know, Chris Cole. These are more of the people for the in-depth discussion on what's going on in the VIX. But what I am familiar with is just markets in general and how to read a chart. And all I got to do is look at that chart and say, we are at the lowest level of the VIX, which is supposed to be kind of a fear index since 2019. And one of the things that I think the general consensus is, or at least I've heard this talked about a lot, is that part of the reason that the VIX has been low is for a long time, the VIX is what traders used to kind of hedge themselves or to, you know, not only to hedge themselves, but to the perceived risk in the market. And now in the last couple of years, there's been a proliferation of options trading. The you know, when I first started in, you know, finance 24, 25 years ago, I mean, people were aware of the VIX and we talked about volatility, but it wasn't really seen as an asset class in and of itself. But over the, you know, since I started, you know, volatility is a whole asset class now. People trade volatility. There's volatility focused funds. There's volatility focused strategies. There's a number of different of these option strategies that people use. And so the proliferation of options trading has grown dramatically, you know, in the last 25 years. And what's really grown a lot in the last couple years, you know, 2 to 3 years, is these very short, not only, so it used to be that you would have options that expired once a month, the kind of like the third Friday of every month options would expire. So if you wanted to trade options on, I don't know, IBM or Coca-Cola or the S&P, you know, typically there was month-end options and then quarter-end options. You know, then maybe, I don't know, 5-10 years ago, you started having these weekly options and they started, you know, trading these options that you know, would expire every week. Now we've gotten to these 1 and 2 day expiration or zero. You know, there's options that you can buy an option today that expires at the close of the market today. And so there's been an explosion in people using these 1, 2, 3 day options, both as a way to get exposure to the upside or hedge their exposure to the downside. And I don't have the numbers in front of me, but the volumes on these have really just exploded. And there's been a lot of discussion that the usage of these very extremely short-term trading, you know, options as trading mechanisms has helped to dampen overall volatility. And I have a sense that it's kind of one of those things that's all well and good until it isn't, right? And if and when some market event happens that comes out of nowhere that people aren't prepared for, and these 1 or 2 day options suddenly gap up overnight And then these positions either get sold or bought because these options force the dealers to hedge their positions or sell positions. It has the potential to cause a bigger eruption, either to the upside or to the downside, than there would be without all these derivatives. Because if you remember, derivatives, options or derivatives, however, it's basically leverage, right? And when you pile on leverage, when the thing that underlies the leverage moves, that's when you get violent moves to the upside and where you can potentially get violent moves to the downside. And so when I see something like this year, where I think the markets are more uncertain now than any time in 25 years that I've been doing this. Now think about this. I started in 99, so I've seen the dot-com crash. I saw the global financial crisis. I've seen the Euro crisis. I saw the Volmageddon. I saw COVID, you know, the repo crisis, like all of these things, right? And yet this is the most uncertain time I can ever remember. And yet VIX, which is the gauge of fear, or at least one of the, what used to be known as fear in the market, is at a, you know, the lowest point in 4 years. This makes no sense to me. I mean, I understand it, but it kind of defies logic. And so I just think that there's more risk out there in the market than is perceived in the VIX. And so I can't sit here and say that the VIX is going to explode higher on Monday or Tuesday, but I am not willing to chance it right now, is the best way to say it. So what I think I've told you this. I have a friend who I talk to every Friday, and he tends to be more optimistic than me, and I tend to be more pessimistic than him. But we don't have that diametrically opposed portfolios. He's, you know, we both own equities. You know, we both have some gold exposure. We both look at currencies all the time. So even though our portfolios don't look dramatically different, I kind of perceive things as more risky. He kind of perceives things as more, you know, sanguine and fine. But yet we've both started buying puts every time the VIX is like under 13 or 14. Like at these levels, we're like, well, why don't we just buy a few puts because it's so cheap, right? And you just don't know. And so for the first part of the year, those didn't help much and they were actually a drag. Now over the last couple of weeks, you know, they helped a lot. And so, you know, until I get more clarity on the market and until VIX gets back to like a reasonable level, I don't think that it's wise to be plunging in without some kind of either cash on the sidelines or protection in your portfolio. So from that sense, I don't think I've really said anything new that we haven't talked about before, John, but when I look at the markets, you know, there's these things like the VIX and these other things that jump out at me that just say, hey, you know, something is mispriced, whether it's gold or whether it's the VIX or it's equities or the 10-year. I just don't think everything is appropriately priced. And so I would rather, you know, sit on the sidelines until I see a really good opportunity. One thing I should say is I'm not recommending that everybody just stay 100% in cash or that they sell their entire portfolio and sit in cash. You know, I haven't done that for my clients, and I'm not saying that you should do that in yours. If you are sitting in cash, I wouldn't be in a big hurry to go put it all to work. But my point is that for years, if sitting in cash meant you didn't make any money, you couldn't get any return. But now with T-bills at 5%, you actually make a pretty good return to just sit there and wait for a better opportunity. So, you know, I'm not somebody who advocates, you know, just, you know, selling everything you own and go hiding out on a mountaintop for 10 years. I just think it's a time to be prudent.
So I do have a follow-up question to let you continue that thread, but I want to attack the last thing you just said there, because getting paid to wait is kind of a new phenomenon in the last two decades. And so, with that in mind, and when you look at the yield curve, it's for the most part flat. Yeah, it's inverted, but let's just call it flat for the intents and purposes of this conversation. So it doesn't really matter what duration you pick, you're going to get paid, let's just say around 4%. So why would an investor, obviously different risk profiles, different objectives, maybe you can kind of highlight a few or just in a broad sense answer this question, but why would somebody who is enjoying the idea of getting paid to wait and maybe has a 12 to 24 month and maybe even a slightly longer expectation that things could get a little dicey, maybe we go into recession. In that event, yields start to steepen on the shorter end of the curve, meaning they increase and you potentially have, I'm sorry, decrease because investors are going into that more risk-off mode, buying treasury bonds, especially on the short end, that pushes the price up and pushes yields down. So if I go and buy a 6-month T-bill or a 12-month T-bill, and I'm enjoying my 4%, and then suddenly something hits the fan and the mood in the markets shift and we now have a risk-off event. Investors are buying bonds, and who knows, maybe even the government's doing, or the central bank, the Fed, is doing QE and artificially suppressing rates by buying bonds. Now all of a sudden, my money's coming back to me as that 12-month bond matures, and instead of reinvesting and getting 4%, maybe I'm only getting 2.5%. So why would someone be buying a short-term T-bill versus kind of hedging that potential where maybe they're able to sell that bond at a premium if it's a 2 or 3 year bond with, you know, another 2 years left on that 4%.
So I think I know the question you're asking here, John, and I'll answer it. But if I'm not hitting on the point, just let me know, and I'll, you know, we'll come back to it. But this is kind of one of the things that fixed income people and just investors in general are wrestling with right now. On the one hand, you can buy very short-term rates, which gives you all kind of optionality, and get 5% or more. Like, I literally bought T-bills today for a client and got 5.37% for a 2-month T-bill. That's pretty darn good, right? The question, though, is why didn't I go in and lock in that high rate for 10 years at like 4.25% or whatever it is? So there's a couple different ways to think about it. On the one hand, if I use short-term rates, I'm getting a very nice coupon while I'm getting paid to wait, and then I have tons of optionality. And the duration is short enough that regardless of what happens to interest rates over the next 2 months or 3 months or 6 months or whatever it is, I'm not going to have much fluctuation in the principal that I'm putting to work. The downside to that is if we, let's say, to your point, we get a huge sell-off in markets, interest rates drop a lot, the Fed goes back to QE, and for whatever reason, I don't feel like buying risk assets at that point. I don't want to go buy equities. I don't want to go buy real estate. I'm retired. I kind of like the life that I have. I want to protect what I have. And so I just want to play it safe. In that case, holding on to 2-month T-bills or 3-month T-bills and then having to reinvest them now at 1% or 1.5% or 2% or 0%, then, you know, I could have locked it in at 4.5% for 10 years. Now, the problem with locking it in at 4.5% for 10 years. Well, number one, there is no problem if you are happy getting 4.5%. And if you believe that inflation is going to stay where it's at or fall, and you're not worried about inflation going to 10%, so you would be losing 5.5% in real terms, then, you know, buying a 10 year is not bad because you're locking in that now much higher rate and you are going to get that money for the next 10 years. The problem comes if interest rates go higher. If interest rates go higher and you have a 10-year bond, the principal is going to fluctuate a lot more on a 10-year bond or a 20-year bond than it is on a T-bill, right? And so this, and I think this is what a lot of people are struggling with. You know, they're sitting here thinking, wow, you know, interest rates have gone up so much, there's probably going to be a risk-off environment. Maybe I just go buy a 10-year and then people say, but why would you hold on to a 10 or a 20 year bond when you know the fiat currency is going to lose value? Well, part of the reason is you're never going to hold that for the full 10 years or 20 years. If interest rates fall, that bond is going to go up a lot in price. And then you can sell it and you not only got that higher rate while you were holding it, but now you get to sell it at a much higher price than you bought it. The flip side is if interest rates continue going higher, right? If for whatever reason we don't get that risk-off event, if inflation stays higher for longer, the Fed keeps hiking rates, people still want to get paid even more to compensate for that higher level of inflation, and then the 10-year rates go to 5.5% or 6% or whatever it is, and now the principal that you put on that bond is underwater. So if you sell it prior to maturity, now you are going to lose some of your capital. And I think this is something that people are struggling with right now. Because I am of the mood or of the opinion as of right now that I want to use the T-bills or the cash I have as dry powder to buy something in a risk-off event, whether it's commodities or gold or stocks or real estate or whatever it is, I am happy skipping the interest rate play right now and just getting the short-term higher interest rate on something like T-bills. But it is, and this is a big debate, right? A lot of people are saying, you know, the 30-year bond or the 20-year bond has just gotten crushed and it's going to continue to do so. While other people are saying, oh, you, not only should you be buying T-bills, you should be buying, you know, TLT or buying the 20 or 30-year bond, because when things turn around, that thing's going to go through the moon. And, you know, there's very good arguments on either side. I don't have conviction on which way interest rates are going, so I am happy to stay out of that argument and just sit in T-bills that pay over 5%.
So not that there's any financial advice being given here, but on one side of the conversation, you're talking about what you're doing as a fiduciary, how you're giving yourself optionality with very, very short-term T-bills. You're getting that over 5% kick just to have that money parked for whatever potential opportunity comes up here. And what you've said many times tends to be a more volatile or risk-off time of year. On the other side, you give the example of, okay, the 10-year, you lock it in, you're getting that cash flow all as well, but now you're kind of risking the potential loss of principal value because of inflation and a loss of real returns. At the same time, you say, well, the reason why someone might do that is it's a little bit of what you're doing, which is getting paid to wait, but they're also speculating on the fact that the price of the bond itself is going to go up, and they're going to be able to, after 2 years, sell that and make a chunk on it. So I think potentially for a lot of people, they're going to fall somewhere in the middle, right? They're not making a 10-year play with the hope of speculation, and maybe 2 months probably doesn't really serve any purpose for them. They could probably just go, you know, put their money in a CD at the bank. So finding a sweet spot is a subjective thing, is really the point you're making. And for some people, you know, potentially something like a 2-year gives you a little bit of both. Yep. So backpedaling just a little bit to the conversation or the points that you were making before, you're talking about the VIX, you're talking about options and some of the things that might be subduing fear in the market, which generally VIX is an indication of. You know, you've also said, you've kind of made this point frequently, and you've also made this point recently with a conversation with Mike Green, that, you know, everything that kind of underpins financial markets and the way things are priced is the dollar. And you look at a chart of the dollar on Bloomberg, and it's just this flat line. And overall, especially with all the conversation that we've had this year about the dollar being dethroned and de-dollarization and BRICS currencies and all these things, you know, the dollar did make a low kind of at the hype of that narrative in July. But since then, we've had 7 up weeks in a row, and we just had the highest weekly close since March. And so what's really, really interesting is not only does this kind of fit into the point you keep making about how the dollar milkshake theory is really trying to educate people on how long this thing could potentially go, but you've also continually kind of made the point about how well central bankers, for, you know, hate them or love them, have been able to keep the plate spinning. So do you think some of this dollar, what some would say is relatively stable, do you think some of what the central banks have been doing, monetary policy and really the balancing of these twin deficits, how it's subdued some of that volatility?
No question. And you listen, I have been pretty vocal saying that I think that the U.S. not only has the ability to, but actually does use monetary policy as, I don't know if I'll, you know, maybe not yet. I have said that monetary policy can be used as a weapon. And now they can use it kind of surgically, or they can use it like a hammer. But I think last year is a very good example of that. I think that they were using it for domestic purposes to squash inflation. But I think they were hyper aware that it was also causing problems overseas for all the other countries. And, you know, all these central bankers at all these different, you know, all these different central banks around the world, they all know each other. They all went to the same schools. They all had the same teachers. They meet at the Bank of International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland every couple months. So there's no doubt that they talk to each other. And I know for a fact that last fall, policymakers in Washington, D.C. were getting calls from all over the world saying, what in the hell are you guys doing? You are killing us. This strong dollar is killing us. And it wasn't too long after that that, you know, Powell's rhetoric as far as rate hikes softened. Now, it also coincided with the data starting to get weaker. And so, you know, also for domestic purposes, he didn't have to be as hawkish. But I also have no doubt that they kind of did that because they, I mean, remember a year ago in September, the Bank of England, the Bank of Japan, China, and the ECB were all kind of on the edge of crisis. And so while central bankers, you know, don't mind causing a little pain here and there, the Fed doesn't mind, you know, messing things up in order to get inflation down, what they don't want is a system collapse, right? They don't want the whole system to come down. And so, you know, I think the fact that the Fed kind of backed off a little bit over the last 9 months or 10 months, however you want to measure that, and they haven't been as, at least in their rhetoric, had not as hawkish in their rhetoric, and that the fact that they've slowed rate hikes has been an attempt to kind of keep the plate spinning, right? If you just keep your foot on the gas the whole time, you're probably going to crash. But if you push sometimes and let off and push, and so listen, and that's my point. I don't necessarily, you know, approve of central banks and their actions, but you know, if you're just sitting back and measuring Powell's either success or failure based on the criteria on which somebody who does believe in central banks is measured, he's done a pretty good job and he's kept the plate spinning. Listen, he's taken interest rates from 0 to 5.5%. VIX is at its all-time low, or it's at a four-year low, and equities are within 4 or 5% of their all-time high. Nobody 18 months ago thought that was possible. Nobody. And so, you know, you could sit here and say Powell's a fool and he doesn't know what he's doing, but if that's the case, then he's the luckiest dude in history because he's actually so far done it. And I've said this before, I don't think it's going to continue. I don't think he's actually going to pull it off. But so far, if you live in the real world, you have to look at the prices on your screen and say, you know what? He has.
Well, we're going to talk about central banks, central bankers, Fed policy, Fed presidents in the U.S., and all the things that are leading up to a potential rate hike again later this month in our Monday peak of the week, which we'll be recording here shortly. But while we're talking about central bankers, at least in the broader context, give some insight into, you know, this week we talked about it earlier in the week on a recording that last week we had the BRICS summit. Then all of a sudden that kind of was no longer worth talking about because it came and went. So then everything was China, China, China at the beginning. And, you know, there's been a lot of emphasis on the fact that China is cutting its FX ratios and reducing treasury purchases and ownerships. Do you want to highlight, you know, potentially some of the reasons for that, what that is really saying that's going on in the system, as well as addressing potentially where all of these things interplay, whether, you know, Japan's going to make some sort of move because they've been chattering a bit?
Yeah, so this is really important to understand. I think, you know, remember from 2014 to 2019, the dollar kind of went sideways to higher, let's call it. And interest rates were at zero. I think they did one hike at the end of 2015, one hike in 2017. And then in 2018-19, they hiked like three or four times, right? But, you know, the point is that, and then leading into, you know, COVID, they were actually cutting and the dollar still went to 102, right? And so the point was, is forget what happened last year. Like the dollar can go up even if they're not hiking interest rates. The dollar can go up on a risk-off environment. The dollar can go up because of what other countries around the world are doing, forgetting what the Fed is doing. And the dollar can go up because we get into some kind of crisis where everybody needs dollars, you know, and because that's the currency that underlies the entire system. Now, last year, the dollar went higher mainly due to rate hikes happening and the perception that rate hikes were going to continue. Once rate hikes stopped rising aggressively and the anticipation for further rate hikes started to fall, then the dollar fell. And so then people say, now the dollar's really done. It's going to keep going down. And they have totally forgotten that last decade, the dollar did very well when there were no rate hikes, right? Or very few rate hikes. And so it's kind of like that recency bias, right? Because the dollar went up last year based on rate hikes, people forget that it can go up for all these different reasons. But there's myriad reasons that can push the dollar higher. And I think that's kind of what we're getting into now. I don't expect the Fed to hike another 5% as they have over the last 18 months. I don't think anybody does. But the reason that the dollar has probably gone higher in the last 6 or 7 weeks, partly is that, you know, the Fed has remained hawkish. We've had enough hawkish data that comes out that says they probably are going to hike again in September, but also the fact that these other countries are having to slow down their expectations for higher rates as well. So as an example, you know, I think part of the reason that the dollar's done well is the euro's pulled back a lot. The euro had a really bad day today. And part of it is that there's this chatter out of Europe that they are not going to be able to continue to raise interest rates. And even if they do, they're not going to be able to stay higher for longer as previously anticipated. So even if the Fed doesn't hike again, and even if they start to cut, if things have to be cut quicker in Europe because their economy is contracting even faster, then the dollar can still go higher. Same thing with Japan, same thing with China. You know, China, you know, to your point, they've been selling treasury bonds. Again, China is not selling treasury bonds as a screw you to the United States and that they're going to, you know, this is an economic weapon of their own. The reason that China is selling treasury bonds is they need dollars. When you sell a treasury bond, you get dollars in return. And they are having a severe credit crunch in their domestic market. And some of their real estate markets has U.S. dollar debts. Now, if you don't think that China's having a credit crisis or if they're in fantastic shape, then why do they keep week after week, month after month, trying to stimulate their markets, cutting reserve requirements, you know, doing these mini bailouts over and over? I mean, that's the reality, is China is struggling right now. And then, you know, Bank of Japan, you know, we've talked about the Bank of Japan several times this year. You know, I don't think anybody thinks they're going to come out and start hiking rates aggressively in Japan. It would blow up their entire banking system. Now, they may... They've talked about loosening the band of their yield curve control. The problem is every time they've talked about doing that, in the days that follow, they've had to go out and buy more bonds than ever before because it starts to blow up their system. And so in some ways, you know, when you're, you know, it's one thing if you're playing poker and you look at the guy across the table that has the biggest stack, that's the Fed, right? They have the most power. But sometimes you can just play the Fed, or sometimes you can play the other four guys at the table based on what they're doing, or women at the table, right? So sometimes you play the hands that are out in front of you. Sometimes you play the individual person. But the point is, you don't always just have to focus on the Fed. And I think if you do just focus on the Fed, you're actually doing yourself a disservice. You need to understand what the other players are doing too, because what the other players are doing can influence what the Fed is doing. And in many ways, what these other players are doing allows the Fed to just sit there and do nothing and stare at its big stack of chips, right? So... I think that's what's starting to play out now, and I think that's what we're going to see more as we get further into the, you know, into the last part of the third quarter and then into the fourth quarter.
Brent, look, man, another phenomenal conversation. I know we talk a lot about this being a relative game, but you said all of that without actually saying it, and I think there's a lot of key aspects of the market that highlighted that this is a relative game. We talk about some of the underlying things that are going on domestically, you know, things that are subduing the market as far as, you know, fear and volatility are concerned locally, but at the same time pulled back a bit and gave a macro view and reminded everybody about this relative game. So before we wrap up on this weekend episode, is there anything else that you'd like to share?
No, I think I'm happy that, you know, it seems from our point of view, just for people that are listening, our point of view, people seem to be tuning in, you know, subscriber base continues to grow slowly but surely. I know, you know, you interact with us on the comment section, which we appreciate. And we hope that you, I mean, again, John and I were having these talks anyway. We're glad that you like listening to them. If you guys have any ideas for certain things you want us to talk about, feel free to suggest them. We'll continue doing it.
Yeah. And we're really loving the fact that you guys like the Madness Edition. We felt kind of brave reintroducing that. And so far the fan feedback has been great. So Brent, thanks very much. For everybody out there who wants to follow Brent on Twitter, you can do that at Santiago AU Fund. You can follow me at John Kutzmita. You can learn more about the show at milkshakespod.com. You can find all our playlists nicely organized for you to slowly work through each bit of content so it doesn't feel like you're drinking from the fire hose on our YouTube channel at milkshakespod is the handle there. That'll do it for this full-length weekend episode. We hope to see you in about a day for the week ahead in our week peek at the week video. And we have a new surprise segment coming for you in the middle of the week. So stay tuned for that. Everybody, thank you. And thank you, Brent, as well. We'll see you all soon. This
show is provided for entertainment and informational purposes only. It should not be relied upon as legal, business, investment, or tax advice. Neither the hosts, guests, nor any funds they may manage intends to make an offer or solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities, investments, or investment strategies.